in the same panel interview, will still disagree about which of the two candidates is better about one quarter of the time. This variability is largely the product of pattern noise, the difference in interviewers' idiosyncratic reactions to a given interviewee. Most organizations fully expect this variability and, for that reason, require several interviewers to meet the same candidate, with the results aggregated in some way. Typically, the aggregate opinion is formed through a discussion in which some sort of consensus must be reached, a procedure that creates its own problems, as we have already noted. A more surprising finding is the presence of much occasion noise in interviews. There is strong evidence, for instance, that hiring recommendations are linked to impressions formed in the informal rapport-building phase of an interview, those first 2 or 3 minutes where you just chat amicably to put the candidate at ease. First impressions turn out to matter a lot. Perhaps you think that judging on first impressions is unproblematic. At least some of what we learn from first impressions is meaningful. All of us know that we do learn something in the first seconds of interaction with a new acquaintance. It stands to reason that this may be particularly true of skilled interviewers. But the first seconds of an interview reflect exactly the sort of superficial qualities you associate with first impressions. Early perceptions are based mostly on a candidate's extroversion and verbal skills. Even the quality of a handshake is a significant predictor of hiring recommendations. We may all like a firm handshake, but few recruiters would consciously choose to make it a key hiring criterion. The psychology of interviewers. Why do first impressions end up driving the outcome of a much longer interview? One reason is that in a traditional interview, interviewers are at liberty to steer the interview in the direction they see fit. They are likely to ask questions that confirm an initial impression. If a candidate seems shy and reserved, for instance, the interviewer may want to ask tough questions about the candidate's past experiences of working in teams, but perhaps will neglect to ask the same questions of someone who seems cheerful and gregarious. The evidence collected about these two candidates will not be the same. One study that tracked the behavior of interviewers who had formed a positive or negative initial impression from resumes and test scores found that initial impressions have a deep effect on the way the interview proceeds. Interviewers with positive first impressions, for instance, ask fewer questions and tend to sell the company to the candidate. The power of first impressions is not the only problematic aspect of interviews. Another is that as interviewers, we want the candidate sitting in front of us to make sense, a manifestation of our excessive tendency, discussed in Chapter 13, to seek and find coherence. In one striking experiment, researchers assigned students to play the role of interviewer or interviewee and told both that the interview should consist only of closed-ended yes or no questions. They then asked some of the interviewees to answer questions randomly. The first letter of the questions as formulated determined if they should answer yes or no. As the researchers wryly note, some of the interviewees were initially concerned that the random interview would break down and be revealed to be nonsense. No such problems occurred, and the interviews proceeded. You heard that right. Not a single interviewer realized that the candidates were giving random answers. Worse, when asked to estimate whether they were able to infer a lot about this person given the amount of time we spent together, interviewers in this random condition were as likely to agree as those who had met candidates responding truthfully. Such is our ability to create coherence. As we can often find an imaginary pattern in random data, or imagine a shape in the contours of a cloud, we are capable of finding logic in perfectly meaningless answers. For a less extreme illustration, consider the following case. One of the present authors had to interview a candidate who was, in his former position, chief financial officer at a mid-sized company. He noticed that the candidate had left this position after a few months and asked him why. The candidate explained that the reason was a strategic disagreement with the CEO. A colleague also interviewed the candidate, asked the same question, and got the same answer. In the debrief that followed, however, the two interviewers had radically different views. One, having so far formed a positive evaluation of the candidate, saw the candidate's decision to leave the company as an indication of integrity and courage. The other, who had formed a negative first impression, construed the same fact as a sign of inflexibility, perhaps even of immaturity. The story illustrates that however much we would like to believe that our judgment about a candidate is based on facts, our interpretation of facts is colored by prior attitudes. The limitations of traditional interviews cast serious doubt on our ability to draw any meaningful conclusions from them. Yet impressions formed in an interview are vivid, and the interviewer is usually confident about them. When combining the conclusions reached in an interview with other cues about the candidate, we tend to give too much weight to the interview and too little to other data that may be more predictive, such as test scores. A story may help bring this observation to life. Professors who interview for a faculty position are often asked to teach in front of a panel of their peers to ensure that their teaching skills are up to the institution's standards. It is, of course, a higher stakes situation than an ordinary class. One of us witnessed a candidate making a bad impression in this exercise, clearly because of the stress of the situation. The candidate's resume mentioned outstanding teaching evaluations and several awards for teaching excellence. Yet the vivid impression produced by his failure in one highly artificial situation weighed more heavily in the final decision than did the abstract data about his excellent past teaching performance. A final point. When interviews are not the only source of information about candidates, for instance, when there are also tests, references, or other inputs, these various inputs must be combined into an overall judgment. The question this raises is one you now recognize. Should the inputs be combined using judgment, a clinical aggregation, or a formula, a mechanical aggregation? As we heard in Chapter 9, the mechanical approach is superior both in general and in the specific case of work performance prediction. Unfortunately, surveys suggest that the overwhelming majority of HR professionals favor clinical aggregation. This practice adds yet another source of noise to an already noisy process. Improving personnel selection through structure. If traditional interviews and judgment-based hiring decisions have limited predictive validity, what can we do about them? Fortunately, research has also produced some advice on how to improve personnel selection, and some companies are paying attention. One example of a company that has upgraded its personnel selection practices and reported on the results is Google. Laszlo Bock, its former senior vice president of people operations, tells the tale in his book, Work Rules. Despite being focused on hiring talent of the highest caliber and devoting considerable resources to finding the right people, Google was struggling. An audit of the predictive validity of its recruiting interviews found zero relationship, a complete random mess. The changes Google implemented to address this situation reflect principles that have emerged from decades of research. They also illustrate decision hygiene strategies. One of these strategies should be familiar by now: aggregation. Its use in this context is not a surprise. Almost all companies aggregate the judgments of multiple interviewers on the same candidate. Not to be outdone, Google sometimes had candidates suffer through 25 interviews. One of the conclusions of Bock's review was to reduce that number to 4, as he found that additional interviews added almost no predictive validity to what was achieved by the first 4. To ensure this level of validity, however, Google stringently enforces a rule that not all companies observe. The company makes sure that the interviewers rate the candidate separately, before they communicate with one another. Once more, aggregation works, but only if the judgments are independent. Google also adopted a decision hygiene strategy we haven't yet described in detail: structuring complex judgments. The term structure can mean many things. As we use the term here, a structured complex judgment is defined by three principles: decomposition, independence, and delayed holistic judgment. The first principle, decomposition, breaks down the decision into components, or mediating assessments. This step serves the same purpose as the identification of the subjudgments in a guideline. It focuses the judges on the important cues. Decomposition acts as a roadmap to specify what data is needed, and it filters out irrelevant information. In Google's case, there are four mediating assessments in the decomposition: general cognitive ability, leadership, cultural fit, called Googliness, and role-related knowledge. Some of these assessments are then broken down into smaller components. Note that a candidate's good looks, smooth talk, exciting hobbies, and any other aspects, positive or negative, that a recruiter might notice in an unstructured interview are not on the list. Creating this sort of structure for a recruiting task may seem like mere common sense. Indeed, if you are hiring an entry-level accountant or an administrative assistant, standard job descriptions exist and specify the competencies needed. As professional recruiters know, however, defining the key assessments gets difficult for unusual or senior positions, and this step of definition is frequently overlooked. One prominent headhunter points out that defining the required competencies in a sufficiently specific manner is a challenging, often overlooked task. He highlights the importance for decision makers of investing in the problem definition, spending the necessary time up front before you meet any candidates to agree on a clear and detailed job description. The challenge here is that many interviewers use bloated job descriptions produced by consensus and compromise. The descriptions are vague wish lists of all the characteristics an ideal candidate would possess, and they offer no way to calibrate the characteristics or make trade-offs among them. The second principle of structured judgment, independence, requires that information on each assessment be collected independently. Just listing the components of the job description is not enough. Most recruiters conducting traditional interviews also know the four or five things they look for in a candidate. The problem is that in the conduct of the interview, they do not evaluate these elements separately. Each assessment influences the others, which makes each assessment very noisy. To overcome this problem, Google orchestrated ways to make assessments in a fact-based manner and independently of one another. Perhaps its most visible move was to introduce structured behavioral interviews. The interviewer's task in such interviews is not to decide whether they like a candidate overall. It is to collect data about each assessment in the evaluation structure and to assign a score to the candidate on each assessment. To do so, interviewers are required to ask predefined questions about the candidate's behaviors in past situations. They must also record the answers and score them against a predetermined rating scale, using a unified rubric. The rubric gives examples of what average, good, or great answers look like for each question. This shared scale, an example of the behaviorally anchored rating scales we introduced in the preceding chapter, helps reduce noise in judgments. If this approach sounds different from a traditional chatty interview, it is. In fact, it can feel more like an exam or interrogation than a business encounter. And there is some evidence that both interviewees and interviewers dislike structured interviews, or at least prefer unstructured ones. There is continuing debate about exactly what an interview must include to qualify as structured. Still, one of the most consistent findings to emerge from the literature on interviewing is that structured interviews are far more predictive of future performance than are traditional unstructured ones. Correlations with job performance range between 0.44 and 0.57. Using our PC metric, your chances of picking the better candidate with a structured interview are between 65 and 69%. A marked improvement over the 56 to 61% chance an unstructured interview would give you. Google uses other data as inputs on some of the dimensions it cares about. To test job-related knowledge, it relies in part on work sample tests, such as asking a candidate for a programming job to write some code. Research has shown that work sample tests are among the best predictors of on-the-job performance. Google also uses backdoor references supplied not by someone the candidate has nominated, but by Google employees with whom the candidate has crossed paths. The third principle of structured judgment, delayed holistic judgment, can be summarized in a simple prescription. Do not exclude intuition, but delay it. At Google, the final hiring recommendation is made collegially by a hiring committee, which reviews a complete file of all the ratings the candidates have obtained on each assessment in each interview, and other relevant information in support of these assessments. On the basis of that information, the committee then decides whether to extend an offer. Despite the famously data-driven culture of this company, and despite all the evidence that a mechanical combination of data outperforms a clinical one, the final hiring decision is not mechanical. It remains a judgment, in which the committee takes all the evidence into account and weighs it holistically, engaging in a discussion of the question, will this person be successful at Google? The decision is not merely computed. In the next chapter, we will explain why we believe that this approach to making the final decision is a sensible one. But note that while they are not mechanical, Google's final hiring decisions are anchored on the average score assigned by the four interviewers. They are also informed by the underlying evidence. In other words, Google allows judgment and intuition in its decision-making process only after all the evidence has been collected and analyzed. Thus, the tendency of each interviewer and hiring committee member to form quick intuitive impressions and rush to judgment is kept in check. The three principles, once more, decomposition, independent assessment on each dimension, and delayed holistic judgment, do not necessarily provide a template for all organizations trying to improve their selection processes. But the principles are broadly consistent with the recommendations that organizational psychologists have formulated over the years. In fact, the principles bear some resemblance to the selection method that one of us, Kahneman, implemented in the Israeli army as early as 1956, and described in Thinking Fast and Slow. That process, like the one Google put in place, formalized an evaluation structure, the list of personality and competence dimensions that had to be evaluated. It required interviewers to elicit objective evidence relevant to each dimension in turn, and to score that dimension before moving on to the next. And it allowed recruiters to use judgment and intuition to reach a final decision, but only after the structured evaluation had taken place. There is overwhelming evidence of the superiority of structured judgment processes, including structured interviews and hiring. Practical advice is available to guide executives who want to adopt them. As the example of Google illustrates, and as other researchers have noted, structured judgment methods are also less costly, because few things are as costly as face time. Nevertheless, most executives remain convinced of the irreplaceable value of informal interview-based methods. Remarkably, so do many candidates who believe that only a face-to-face interview will enable them to show a prospective employer their true mettle. Researchers have called this the persistence of an illusion. One thing is clear. Recruiters and candidates severely underestimate the noise in hiring judgments. Speaking of structure in hiring, in traditional informal interviews, we often have an irresistible intuitive feeling of understanding the candidate and knowing whether the person fits the bill. We must learn to distrust that feeling. Traditional interviews are dangerous not only because of biases, but also because of noise. We must add structure to our interviews and more broadly to our selection processes. Let's start by defining much more clearly and specifically what we are looking for in candidates, and let's make sure we evaluate the candidates independently on each of these dimensions. Chapter 25. The Mediating Assessments Protocol. Some time ago, two of us, Kahneman and Siboney, together with our friend Dan Lavallo, described a method of decision-making in organizations. We called the method, which was designed with noise mitigation as a primary objective, the Mediating Assessments Protocol. It incorporates most of the decision hygiene strategies that we have introduced in the preceding chapters. The protocol can be applied broadly and whenever the evaluation of a plan or an option requires considering and weighting multiple dimensions. It can be used and adapted in various ways by organizations of all kinds, including diverse companies, hospitals, universities, and government agencies. We illustrate the protocol here with a stylized example that is a composite of several real cases. A fictitious corporation we'll call MAPCO. We will follow the steps MAPCO takes as it studies the opportunity to make a major transformative acquisition, and we will highlight how these differ from the usual steps a company takes in such a situation. As you will see, the differences are significant but subtle. An inattentive observer might not even notice them. The first meeting, agreeing on the approach. The idea of acquiring Rodco, a competitor, had been percolating at MAPCO and had matured sufficiently so that the company's leaders were contemplating a board meeting to discuss it. Joan Morrison, the CEO of MAPCO, convened a meeting of the board's strategy committee for a preliminary discussion of the possible acquisition and of what should be done to improve the board's deliberations about it. Early in the meeting, Joan surprised the committee with a proposal. I would like to propose that we try a new procedure for the board meeting where we will decide on the Rodco acquisition. The new procedure has an unappealing name, the Mediating Assessments Protocol, but the idea is really quite simple. It is inspired by the similarity between the evaluation of a strategic option and the evaluation of a job candidate. You are certainly familiar with the research that shows that structured interviews produce better results than unstructured ones, and more broadly with the idea that structuring a hiring decision improves it. You know that our HR department has adopted these principles for its hiring decisions. A vast amount of research shows that structure in interviews leads to much higher accuracy. Unstructured interviews, as we used to practice them, don't even come close. I see a clear similarity between the evaluation of candidates and the evaluation of options in big decisions. Options are like candidates, and this similarity leads me to the idea that we should adapt the method that works for evaluating candidates to our task, which is to evaluate strategic options. The committee members were initially puzzled by the analogy. The recruiting process, they argued, is a well-oiled machine that makes numerous similar decisions and is not under severe time pressure. A strategic decision, on the other hand, requires a great deal of ad hoc work and must be made quickly. Some committee members made clear to Joan that they would be hostile to any proposal that delayed the decision. They were also worried about adding to the due diligence requirements from MAPCO's research staff. Joan responded directly to these objections. She assured her colleagues that the structured process would not delay the decision. "This is all about setting the agenda for the board meeting in which we will discuss the deal," she explained. "We should decide in advance on a list of assessments of different aspects of the deal, just as an interviewer starts with a job description that serves as a checklist of traits or attributes a candidate must possess. We will make sure the board discusses these assessments separately, one by one, just as interviewers in structured interviews evaluate the candidate on these separate dimensions in sequence. Then and only then will we turn to a discussion of whether to accept or reject the deal. This procedure will be a much more effective way to take advantage of the collective wisdom of the board. If we agree on this approach, of course, it has implications for how the information should be presented, and for how the deal team should work to prepare the meeting. That's why I wanted to get your thoughts now." One committee member, still skeptical, asked Joan what benefits the structure brought to the quality of decision-making in hiring and why she believed these benefits would transfer to a strategic decision. Joan walked him through the logic. Using the Mediating Assessments Protocol, she explained, maximizes the value of information by keeping the dimensions of the evaluation independent of each other. The board discussions we usually have look a lot like unstructured interviews, she observed. We are constantly aware of the final goal of reaching a decision, and we process all the information in light of that goal. We start out looking for closure, and we achieve it as soon as we can. Just like a recruiter in an unstructured interview, we are at risk of using all the debate to confirm our first impressions. Using a structured approach will force us to postpone the goal of reaching a decision until we have made all the assessments. We will take on the separate assessments as intermediate goals. This way, we will consider all the information available and make sure that our conclusion on one aspect of the deal does not change our reading on another unrelated aspect. The committee members agreed to try out the approach, but they asked, what were the mediating assessments? Was there a predefined checklist that Joan had in mind? No, she replied. That might be the case if we applied the protocol to a routine decision, but in this case, we need to define the mediating assessments ourselves. This is critically important. Deciding on the major aspects of the acquisition that should be assessed is up to us. The strategy committee agreed to meet again the next day to do that. The second meeting. Defining the mediating assessments. The first thing we are going to do, Joan explained, is draw up a comprehensive list of independent assessments about the deal. These will be assessed by Jeff Schneider's research team. Our task today is to construct the list of assessments. It should be comprehensive in the sense that any relevant fact you can think of should find its place and should influence at least one of the assessments. And what I mean by independent is that a relevant fact should preferably influence only one of the assessments to minimize redundancy. The group got to work and generated a long list of facts and data that seemed relevant. It then organized them into a list of assessments. The challenge, the participants soon discovered, was to make the list short, comprehensive, and composed of non-overlapping assessments. But the task was manageable. Indeed, the group's final list of 7 assessments was superficially similar to the table of contents the board would expect in a regular report presenting an acquisition proposal. In addition to the expected financial modeling, the list included, for instance, an evaluation of the quality of the target's management team, and an assessment of the likelihood that the anticipated synergies would be captured. Some of the strategy committee members were disappointed that the meeting did not produce novel insights about Rodco. But Joan explained that was not the goal. The immediate objective was to brief the deal team in charge of studying the acquisition. Each assessment, she said, would be the subject of a different chapter in the deal team's report, and would be discussed separately by the board. The deal team's mission, as Joan saw it, was not to tell the board what it thought of the deal as a whole, at least not yet. It was to provide an objective, independent evaluation on each of the mediating assessments. Ultimately, Joan explained, each chapter in the deal team's report should end with a rating that answers a simple question. Leaving aside the weight we should give this topic in the final decision, how strongly does the evidence of this assessment argue for or against the deal? The deal team. The leader of the team in charge of evaluating the deal, Jeff Schneider, got his team together that afternoon to organize the work. The changes from the team's usual way of working were not many, but he stressed their importance. First, he explained, the team's analysts should try to make their analyses as objective as possible. The evaluations should be based on facts, nothing new about that, but they should also use an outside view whenever possible. Since the team members were unsure of what he meant by outside view, Jeff gave them 2 examples, using 2 of the mediating assessments Joan had identified. To evaluate the probability that the deal would receive regulatory approval, he said, they would need to start by finding out the base rate, the percentage of comparable transactions that are approved. This task would, in turn, require them to define a relevant reference class, a group of deals considered comparable enough. Jeff then explained how to evaluate the technological skills of the target's product development department, another important assessment Joan had listed. It is not enough to describe the company's recent achievements in a fact-based way and to call them good or great. What I expect is something like, "This product development department is in the second quintile of its peer group, as measured by its recent track record of product launches." Overall, he explained, the goal was to make evaluations as comparative as possible, because relative judgments are better than absolute ones. Jeff had another request. In keeping with Jones' instructions, he said, assessments should be as independent of one another as possible, to reduce the risk that one assessment would influence the others. Accordingly, he assigned different analysts to the different assessments, and he instructed them to work independently. Some of the analysts expressed surprise. "Isn't teamwork better?" they asked him. "What's the point of assembling a team if you don't want us to communicate?" Jeff realized he needed to explain the need for independence. "You probably know about the halo effect in recruiting," he said. "That is what happens when the general impression of a candidate influences your assessment of the candidate's skills on a specific dimension. That's what we are trying to avoid." Since some of the analysts seemed to think that this effect was not a serious problem, Jeff used another analogy. "If you have four witnesses to a crime, would you let them talk to each other before testifying? Obviously not. You don't want one witness to influence the others." The analysts did not find the comparison particularly flattering, but it got the message across, Jeff thought. As it happened, Jeff did not have enough analysts to achieve the goal of perfectly independent assessments. Jane, an experienced member of the team, was charged with two assessments. Jeff chose the two to be as different from each other as possible, and he instructed Jane to complete the first assessment and prepare the report on it before turning to the other. Another concern was the evaluation of the quality of the management team. Jeff was worried that his analysts would struggle to dissociate their assessment of the team's intrinsic quality from judgments about the company's recent results, which the team would, of course, study in detail. To address this issue, Jeff asked an outside HR expert to weigh in on the quality of the management team. This way, he thought, he would obtain a more independent input. Jeff had another instruction that the team found somewhat unusual. Each chapter should focus on one assessment and, as requested by Joan, lead to a conclusion in the form of a rating. However, Jeff added, the analysts should include in each chapter all the relevant factual information about the assessment. "Don't hide anything," he instructed them. The general tone of the chapter will be consistent with the proposed rating, of course, but if there is information that seems inconsistent or even contradictory with the main rating, don't sweep anything under the rug. Your job is not to sell your recommendation. It is to represent the truth. If it is complicated, so be it. It often is. In the same spirit, Jeff encouraged the analysts to be transparent about their level of confidence in each assessment. The board knows that you do not have perfect information. It will help them if you tell them when you're really in the dark. And if you run into something that really gives you pause, a potential deal breaker, you should, of course, report it immediately. The deal team proceeded as instructed. Fortunately, it found no major deal breakers. It assembled a report for Joan and the board covering all the assessments identified. The decision meeting. As she read the team's report to prepare for the decision meeting, Joan immediately noticed something important. While most of the assessments supported doing the deal, they did not paint a simple, rosy, all-systems-go picture. Some of the ratings were strong. Others were not. These differences, she knew, were a predictable result of keeping the assessments independent of one another. When excessive coherence is kept in check, reality is not as coherent as most board presentations make it seem. Good, Joan thought. These discrepancies between assessments will raise questions and trigger discussions. That's just what we need to have a good debate in the board. The diverse results will not make the decision easier, for sure, but they will make it better. Joan convened a meeting of the board to review the report and come to a decision. She explained the approach that the deal team followed and she invited the board members to apply the same principle. Jeff and his team have worked hard to keep the assessments independent of each other, she said, and our task now is to review them independently too. This means we will consider each assessment separately before we start discussing the final decision. We are going to treat each assessment as a distinct agenda item. The board members knew that following this structured approach would be difficult. Joan was asking them not to form a holistic view of the deal before all assessments were discussed, but many of them were industry insiders. They had a view on Roadco. Not discussing it felt a bit artificial. Nevertheless, because they understood what Joan was trying to achieve, they agreed to play by her rules and refrain temporarily from discussing their overall views. To their surprise, the board members found that this practice was highly valuable. During the meeting, some of them even changed their mind about the deal, although no one would ever know since they had kept their views to themselves. The way Joan ran the meeting played a large part. She used the estimate-talk-estimate method, which combines the advantages of deliberation and those of averaging independent opinions. Here is how she proceeded. On each assessment, Jeff, on behalf of the deal team, briefly summarized the key facts, which the board members had read in detail beforehand. Then Joan asked the board members to use a voting app on their phones to give their own rating on the assessment, either the same as the deal team's proposed rating or a different one. The distribution of ratings was projected immediately on the screen without identifying the raters. This is not a vote, Joan explained. We are just taking the temperature of the room on each topic. By getting an immediate read on each board member's independent opinion before starting a discussion, Joan reduced the danger of social influence and information cascades. On some assessments, there was immediate consensus, but on others, the process revealed opposing views. Naturally, Joan managed the discussion to spend more time on the latter. She made sure that board members on each side of the divide spoke up, encouraging them to express their viewpoints with facts and arguments, but also with nuance and humility. Once, when a board member who felt strongly about the deal got carried away, she reminded him that, "We are all reasonable people and we disagree, so this must be a subject on which reasonable people can disagree." When the discussion of an assessment drew to a close, Joan asked the board members to vote again on a rating. Most of the time, there was more convergence than in the initial round. The same sequence, a first estimate, a discussion, and a second estimate, was repeated for each assessment. Finally, it was time to reach a conclusion about the deal. To facilitate the discussion, Jeff showed the list of assessments on the whiteboard with, for each assessment, the average of the ratings that the board had assigned to it. The board members were looking at the profile of the deal. How should they decide? One board member had a simple suggestion. Use a straight average of the ratings. Perhaps he knew about the superiority of mechanical aggregation over holistic clinical judgment, as discussed in Chapter 9. Another member, however, immediately objected that, in her view, some of the assessments should be given a much higher weight than others. A third person disagreed, suggesting a different hierarchy of the assessments. Joan interrupted the discussion. "This is not just about computing a simple combination of the assessment ratings," she said. "We have delayed intuition, but now is the time to use it. What we need now is your judgment." Joan did not explain her logic, but she had learned this lesson the hard way. She knew that, particularly with important decisions, people reject schemes that tie their hands and do not let them use their judgment. She had seen how decision makers game the system when they know that a formula will be used. They change the ratings to arrive at the desired conclusion, which defeats the purpose of the entire exercise. Furthermore, although this was not the case here, she remained alert to the possibility that decisive considerations could emerge that were not anticipated in the definition of assessments, the broken leg factors discussed in Chapter 10. If such unanticipated deal breakers, or conversely, deal clinchers, appeared, a purely mechanical decision process based on the average of the assessments might lead to a serious mistake. Joan also knew that letting the board members use their intuition at this stage was very different from having them use it earlier in the process. Now that the assessments were available and known to all, the final decision was safely anchored on these fact-based, thoroughly discussed ratings. A board member would need to come up with strong reasons to be against the deal while staring at a list of mediating assessments that mostly supported it. Following this logic, the board discussed the deal and voted on it, in much the same way all boards do. The Mediating Assessments Protocol in Recurring Decisions. We have described the Mediating Assessments Protocol in the context of a one-off singular decision, but the procedure applies to recurring decisions too. Imagine that MAPCO is not making a single acquisition, but is a venture capital fund that makes repeated investments in startups. The protocol would be just as applicable and the story would be much the same, with just two twists that, if anything, make it simpler. First, the initial step. Defining the list of mediating assessments needs to be done only once. The fund has investment criteria which it applies to all its prospective investments. These are the assessments. There is no need to reinvent them each time. Second, if the fund makes many decisions of the same type, it can use its experience to calibrate its judgments. Consider, for instance, an assessment that every fund will want to make, evaluating the quality of the management team. We suggested that such evaluations should be made relative to a reference class. Perhaps you sympathized with the analysts of MAPCO, gathering data about comparable companies in addition to evaluating a specific target is challenging. Comparative judgments become much easier in the context of a recurring decision. If you have evaluated the management teams of dozens, even hundreds of companies, you can use this shared experience as a reference class. A practical way to do this is to create a case scale defined by anchor cases. You might say, for instance, that the target management team is as good as the management team of ABC company when we acquired it, but not quite as good as the management team of DEF company. The anchor cases must, of course, be known to all the participants and periodically updated. Defining them requires an upfront investment of time. But the value of this approach is that relative judgments, comparing this team to the ones at ABC and DEF, are much more reliable than our absolute ratings on a scale defined by numbers or adjectives. What the protocol changes. For ease of reference, we summarize the main changes that the Mediating Assessments Protocol entails in Table 4. Table 4. Main steps of the Mediating Assessments Protocol. 1. At the beginning of the process, structure the decision into mediating assessments. For recurring judgments, this is done only once. 2. Ensure that whenever possible, mediating assessments use an outside view. For recurring judgments, use relative judgments with a case scale if possible. 3. In the analytical phase, keep the assessments as independent of one another as possible. 4. In the decision meeting, review each assessment separately. 5. On each assessment, ensure that participants make their judgments individually, then use the estimate-talk-estimate method. 6. To make the final decision, delay intuition, but don't ban it. You may have recognized here an implementation of several of the decision hygiene techniques we presented in the preceding chapters. Sequencing information, structuring the decision into independent assessments, using a common frame of reference grounded in the outside view, and aggregating the independent judgments of multiple individuals. By implementing these techniques, the Mediating Assessments Protocol aims to change the decision process to introduce as much decision hygiene as possible. No doubt this emphasis on process, as opposed to the content of decisions, may raise some eyebrows. The reactions of the research team members and the board members, as we have described them, are not unusual. Content is specific, process is generic. Using intuition and judgment is fun. Following process is not. Conventional wisdom holds that good decisions, especially the very best ones, emerge from the insight and creativity of great leaders. We especially like to believe this when we are the leader in question. And to many, the word process evokes bureaucracy, red tape, and delays. Our experience with companies and government agencies that have implemented all or some of the components of the protocol suggests that these concerns are misguided. To be sure, adding complexity to the decision-making processes of an organization that is already bureaucratic will not make things better. But decision hygiene need not be slow, and certainly doesn't need to be bureaucratic. On the contrary, it promotes challenge and debate, not the stifling consensus that characterizes bureaucracies. The case for decision hygiene is clear. Leaders in business and in the public sector are usually entirely unaware of noise in their largest and most important decisions. As a result, they take no specific measures to reduce it. In that respect, they are just like the recruiters who continue to rely on unstructured interviews as their sole personnel selection tool. Oblivious to the noise in their own judgment, more confident in its validity than they should be, and unaware of procedures that could improve it. Handwashing does not prevent all diseases. Likewise, decision hygiene will not prevent all mistakes. It will not make every decision brilliant. But like handwashing, it addresses an invisible yet pervasive and damaging problem. Wherever there is judgment, there is noise. And we propose decision hygiene as a tool to reduce it. Speaking of the mediating assessments protocol, we have a structured process to make hiring decisions. Why don't we have one for strategic decisions? After all, options are like candidates. This is a difficult decision. What are the mediating assessments it should be based on? Our intuitive, holistic judgment about this plan is very important, but let's not discuss it yet. Our intuition will serve us much better once it is informed by the separate assessments we have asked for. Part 6. Optimal Noise. In 1973, Judge Marvin Frankel was right to call for a sustained effort to reduce noise in criminal sentencing. His informal, intuitive noise audit, followed by more formal and systematic efforts, uncovered unjustified disparities in the treatment of similar people. Those disparities were outrageous. They were also startling. Much of this book can be understood as an effort to generalize Frankel's arguments and to offer an understanding of their psychological foundations. To some people, noise in the criminal justice system seems uniquely intolerable, even scandalous. But in countless other contexts, it is not exactly tolerable, as supposedly interchangeable people in the private and public sectors make different judgments on the job. In insurance, recruitment, and evaluation of employees, medicine, forensic science, education, business, and government, interpersonal noise is a major source of error. We have also seen that each of us is subject to occasion noise, in the sense that supposedly irrelevant factors can lead us to make different judgments in the morning and in the afternoon, or on Monday and Thursday. But as the intensely negative judicial reaction to the sentencing guidelines suggests, noise reduction efforts often run into serious and even passionate objections. Many people have argued that the guidelines are rigid, dehumanizing, and unfair in their own way. Almost everyone has had the experience of making a reasonable request to a company, an employer, or a government, only to be met with the response, "We really would love to help you, but our hands are tied. We have clear rules here." The rules in question may seem stupid and even cruel, but they may have been adopted for a good reason, to reduce noise and perhaps bias as well. Even so, some efforts to reduce noise raise serious concerns. Perhaps above all if they make it difficult or impossible for people to get a fair hearing. The use of algorithms and machine learning has put that objection in a new light. No one is marching under a banner that says algorithms now. An influential critique comes from Kate Stith of Yale Law School and Jose Cabranes, a federal judge. They offered a vigorous attack on the sentencing guidelines and, in a sense, on one of our central arguments here. Their argument was limited to the area of criminal sentencing, but it can be offered as an objection to many noise reduction strategies in education, business, sports, and everywhere else. Stith and Cabranes maintain that the sentencing guidelines are animated by a fear of the exercise of discretion, by a fear of judging, and by a technocratic faith in experts and central planning. They argue that fear of judging operates to forbid consideration of the particulars of each case at hand. In their view, no mechanical solution can satisfy the demands of justice. These objections are worth examining. In settings that involve judgments of all kinds, people often view the demands of justice as forbidding any sort of mechanical solution, and hence allowing or even mandating processes and approaches that turn out to guarantee noise. Many people call for attention to the particulars of each case at hand. In hospitals, schools, and firms, large and small, this call has a deep intuitive appeal. We have seen that decision hygiene includes diverse strategies for reducing noise, and most of them do not involve mechanical solutions. When people decompose a problem into its component parts, their judgments need not be mechanical. Even so, many people would not welcome the use of decision hygiene strategies. We have defined noise as unwanted variability, and if something is unwanted, it should probably be eliminated. But the analysis is more complicated and more interesting than that. Noise may be unwanted, other things being equal, but other things might not be equal, and the costs of eliminating noise might exceed the benefits. And even when an analysis of costs and benefits suggests that noise is costly, eliminating it might produce a range of awful or even unacceptable consequences for both public and private institutions. There are 7 major objections to efforts to reduce or eliminate noise. First, reducing noise can be expensive. It might not be worth the trouble. The steps that are necessary to reduce noise might be highly burdensome. In some cases, they might not even be feasible. Second, some strategies introduced to reduce noise might introduce errors of their own. Occasionally, they might produce systematic bias. If all forecasters in a government office adopted the same unrealistically optimistic assumptions, their forecasts would not be noisy, but they would be wrong. If all doctors at a hospital prescribed aspirin for every illness, they would not be noisy, but they would make plenty of mistakes. We explore these objections in Chapter 26. In Chapter 27, we turn to 5 more objections, which are also common and which are likely to be heard in many places in coming years, especially with increasing reliance on rules, algorithms, and machine learning. Third, if we want people to feel that they have been treated with respect and dignity, we might have to tolerate some noise. Noise can be a byproduct of an imperfect process that people end up embracing because the process gives everyone, employees, customers, applicants, students, those accused of crime, an individualized hearing, an opportunity to influence the exercise of discretion, and a sense that they have had a chance to be seen and heard. Fourth, noise might be essential to accommodate new values and hence to allow moral and political evolution. If we eliminate noise, we might reduce our ability to respond when moral and political commitments move in new and unexpected directions. A noise-free system might freeze existing values. Fifth, some strategies designed to reduce noise might encourage opportunistic behavior, allowing people to game the system or evade prohibitions. A little noise, or perhaps a lot of it, might be necessary to prevent wrongdoing. Sixth, a noisy process might be a good deterrent. If people know that they could be subject to either a small penalty or a large one, they might steer clear of wrongdoing, at least if they are risk-averse. A system might tolerate noise as a way of producing extra deterrence. Finally, people do not want to be treated as if they are mere things or cogs in some kind of machine. Some noise reduction strategies might squelch people's creativity and prove demoralizing. Although we will address these objections as sympathetically as we can, we by no means endorse them, at least not if they are taken as reasons to reject the general goal of reducing noise. To presage a point that will recur throughout, Whether an objection is convincing depends on the particular noise reduction strategy to which it is meant to apply. You might, for example, object to rigid guidelines while also agreeing that aggregation of independent judgments is a good idea. You might object to the use of the mediating assessments protocol while strongly favoring the use of a shared scale grounded in the outside view. With these points in mind, our general conclusion is that even when the objections are given their due, noise reduction remains a worthy and even an urgent goal. In Chapter 28, we defend this conclusion by exploring a dilemma that people face every day, even if they are not always aware of it. Chapter 26: The Costs of Noise Reduction. Whenever people are asked to eliminate noise, they might object that the necessary steps are just too expensive. In extreme circumstances, noise reduction is simply not possible. We have heard this objection in business, education, government, and elsewhere. There is a legitimate concern here, but it is easily overstated and it is often just an excuse. To put the objection in its most appealing light, consider the case of a high school teacher who grades 25 essays by 10th graders during each week of the school year. If the teacher spends no more than 15 minutes on each essay, the grading might be noisy and therefore inaccurate and unfair. The teacher might consider a little decision hygiene, perhaps reducing the noise by asking a colleague to grade the essays as well, so that two people are reading every paper. Perhaps the teacher could accomplish the same goal by spending more time reading each essay, structuring the relatively complex process of assessment, or by reading the essays more than once and in different orders. A detailed grading guideline used as a checklist might help, or perhaps the educator could make sure to read each essay at the same time of day, so as to reduce occasion noise. But if the teacher's own judgments are pretty accurate and not terribly noisy, it might be sensible not to do any of these things. It might not be worth the bother. The teacher might think that using a checklist or asking a colleague to read the same papers would be a form of overkill. To know whether it is, a disciplined analysis might be necessary. How much more accuracy would the teacher gain? How important is more accuracy? And how much time and money would be required by the effort to reduce noise? We could easily imagine a limit on how much to invest in noise reduction. We could just as easily see that this limit should be different when the essays are written by ninth graders or as senior theses, where university admission may be on the line and the stakes are higher. The basic analysis might be extended to more complex situations faced by private and public organizations of all kinds, leading them to reject some noise reduction strategies. For some diseases, hospitals and doctors might struggle to identify simple guidelines to eliminate variability. In the case of divergent medical diagnoses, efforts to reduce noise have particular appeal. They might save lives. But the feasibility and costs of those efforts need to be taken into account. A test might eliminate noise in diagnoses, but if the test is invasive, dangerous, and costly, and if variability in diagnoses is modest and has only mild consequences, then it might not be worthwhile for all doctors to require all patients to take the test. Rarely does the evaluation of employees involve life and death. But noise can result in unfairness for employees and high costs for the firm. We have seen that efforts to reduce noise should be feasible. Are they worthwhile? Cases involving clearly mistaken evaluations might get noticed and seem embarrassing, shameful, or worse. Nonetheless, an institution might think that elaborate corrective steps are not worth the effort. Sometimes that conclusion is short-sighted, self-serving, and wrong, even catastrophically so. Some form of decision hygiene might well be worthwhile, but the belief that it is too expensive to reduce noise is not always wrong. In short, we have to compare the benefits of noise reduction with the costs. That is fair, and it is one reason noise audits are so important. In many situations, the audits reveal that noise is producing outrageous levels of unfairness, very high costs, or both. If so, the cost of noise reduction is hardly a good reason not to make the effort. Less noise, more mistakes? A different objection is that some noise reduction efforts might themselves produce unacceptably high levels of error. The objection might be convincing if the instruments used to reduce noise are too blunt. In fact, some efforts at noise reduction might even increase bias. If a social media platform such as Facebook or Twitter introduced firm guidelines that call for removing all posts containing certain vulgar words, its decisions will be less noisy, but it will be taking down numerous posts that should be allowed to stay up. These false positives are a directional error, a bias. Life is full of institutional reforms that are designed to reduce the discretion of people and practices that generate noise. Many such reforms are well motivated, but some cures are worse than the disease. In The Rhetoric of Reaction, economist Albert Hirschman points to three common objections to reform efforts. First, such efforts might be perverse in the sense that they will aggravate the very problem they are intended to solve. Second, they might be futile. They might not change things at all. Third, they put other important values in jeopardy, such as when an effort to protect labor unions and the right to unionize is said to hurt economic growth. Perversity, futility, and jeopardy might be offered as objections to noise reduction, and of the three, claims of perversity and jeopardy tend to be the most powerful. Sometimes these objections are just rhetoric, an effort to derail a reform that will actually do a great deal of good. But some noise reduction strategies could jeopardize important values, and for others, the risk of perversity might not be readily dismissed. The judges who objected to the sentencing guidelines were pointing to that risk. They were well aware of Judge Frankel's work, and they did not deny that discretion produces noise. But they thought that reducing discretion would produce more mistakes, not fewer. Quoting Vaclav Havel, they insisted, "We have to abandon the arrogant belief that the world is merely a puzzle to be solved, a machine with instructions for use waiting to be discovered, a body of information to be fed into a computer in the hope that sooner or later it will spit out a universal solution." One reason for rejecting the idea of universal solutions is an insistent belief that human situations are highly varied, and that good judges address the variations, which might mean tolerating noise, or at least rejecting some noise reduction strategies. In the early days of computer chess, a large airline offered a chess program for international passengers, who were invited to play against a computer. The program had several levels. At the lowest level, the program used a simple rule: place your opponent's king in check whenever you can. The program was not noisy. It played the same way every time. It would always follow its simple rule. But the rule ensured a great deal of error. The program was terrible at chess. Even inexperienced chess players could defeat it, which was undoubtedly the point. Winning air travelers are happy air travelers. Or consider the criminal sentencing policy adopted in some U.S. states and called three strikes and you're out. The idea is that if you commit three felonies, your sentence is life imprisonment, period. The policy reduces the variability that comes from random assignments of the sentencing judge. Some of its proponents were especially concerned about level noise and the possibility that some judges were too lenient with hardened criminals. Eliminating noise is the central point of the three strikes legislation. But even if the three strikes policy succeeds in its noise reduction goal, we can reasonably object that the price of this success is too high. Some people who have committed three felonies should not be put away for life. Perhaps their crimes were not violent, or their awful life circumstances might have helped lead them to crime. Maybe they show a capacity for rehabilitation. Many people think that a life sentence, inattentive to the particular circumstances, is not only too harsh, but also intolerably rigid. For that reason, the price of that noise reduction strategy is too high. Consider the case of Woodson v. North Carolina, in which the U.S. Supreme Court held that a mandatory death sentence was unconstitutional, not because it was too brutal, but because it was a rule. The whole point of the mandatory death sentence was to ensure against noise. To say that under specified circumstances, murderers would have to be put to death. Invoking the need for individualized treatment, the court said that the belief no longer prevails that every offense in a like legal category calls for an identical punishment without regard to the past life and habits of a particular offender. According to the Supreme Court, a serious constitutional shortcoming of the mandatory death sentence is that it treats all persons convicted of a designated offense not as uniquely individual human beings, but as members of a faceless, undifferentiated mass to be subjected to the blind infliction of the penalty of death. The death penalty involves especially high stakes, of course, but the court's analysis can be applied to many other situations, most of them not involving law at all. Teachers evaluating students, doctors evaluating patients, employers evaluating employees, underwriters setting insurance premiums, coaches evaluating athletes. All these people might make mistakes if they apply overly rigid noise-reducing rules. If employers use simple rules for evaluating, promoting, or suspending employees, those rules might eliminate noise while neglecting important aspects of the employee's performance. A noise-free scoring system that fails to take significant variables into account might be worse than reliance on noisy individual judgments. Chapter 27 considers the general idea of treating people as uniquely individual, rather than as members of a faceless, undifferentiated mass. For now, we are focusing on a more prosaic point. Some noise reduction strategies ensure too many mistakes. They might be a lot like that foolish chess program. Still, the objection seems far more convincing than it actually is. If one noise reduction strategy is error-prone, we should not rest content with high levels of noise. We should instead try to devise a better noise reduction strategy. For example, aggregating judgments rather than adopting silly rules or developing wise guidelines or rules rather than foolish ones. In the interest of noise reduction, a university could say, for example, that people with the highest test scores will be admitted, and that's it. If that rule seems too crude, the school could create a formula that takes account of test scores, grades, age, athletic achievements, family background, and more. Complex rules might be more accurate, more attuned to the full range of relevant factors. Similarly, doctors have complex rules for diagnosing some illnesses. The guidelines and rules used by professionals are not always simple or crude, and many of them help reduce noise without creating intolerably high costs or bias. And if guidelines or rules will not work, perhaps we could introduce other forms of decision hygiene suited to the particular situation that will recall aggregating judgments or using a structured process such as the mediating assessments protocol. Noiseless biased algorithms. The potentially high costs of noise reduction often come up in the context of algorithms, where there are growing objections to algorithmic bias. As we have seen, algorithms eliminate noise and often seem appealing for that reason. Indeed, much of this book might be taken as an argument for greater reliance on algorithms simply because they are noiseless. But as we have also seen, noise reduction can come at an intolerable cost if greater reliance on algorithms increases discrimination on the basis of race and gender, or against members of disadvantaged groups. There are widespread fears that algorithms will, in fact, have that discriminatory consequence, which is undoubtedly a serious risk. In Weapons of Math Destruction, mathematician Kathy O'Neill urges that reliance on the big data and decision by algorithm can embed prejudice, increase inequality, and threaten democracy itself. According to another skeptical account, potentially biased mathematical models are remaking our lives, and neither the companies responsible for developing them nor the government is interested in addressing the problem. According to ProPublica, an independent investigative journalism organization, Compass, an algorithm widely used in recidivism risk assessments, is strongly biased against members of racial minorities. No one should doubt that it is possible, even easy, to create an algorithm that is noise-free, but also racist, sexist, or otherwise biased. An algorithm that explicitly uses the color of a defendant's skin to determine whether that person should be granted bail would discriminate, and its use would be unlawful in many nations. An algorithm that takes account of whether job applicants might become pregnant would discriminate against women. In these and other cases, algorithms could eliminate unwanted variability in judgment, but also embed unacceptable bias. In principle, we should be able to design an algorithm that does not take account of race or gender. Indeed, an algorithm could be designed that disregards race or gender entirely. The more challenging problem, now receiving a great deal of attention, is that an algorithm could discriminate and, in that sense, turn out to be biased, even when it does not overtly use race and gender as predictors. As we have suggested, an algorithm might be biased for two main reasons. First, by design or not, it could use predictors that are highly correlated with race or gender. For example, height and weight are correlated with gender, and the place where people grew up or where they live might well be correlated with race. Second, discrimination could also come from the source data. If an algorithm is trained on a data set that is biased, it will be biased too. Consider predictive policing algorithms, which attempt to predict crime, often in order to improve the allocation of police resources. If the existing data about crime reflects the over-policing of certain neighborhoods or the comparative over-reporting of certain types of offenses, then the resulting algorithms will perpetuate or exacerbate discrimination. Whenever there is bias in the training data, it is quite possible to design, intentionally or unintentionally, an algorithm that encodes discrimination. It follows that even if an algorithm does not expressly consider race or gender, it could turn out to be as biased as human beings are. Indeed, in this regard, algorithms could be worse. Since they eliminate noise, they could be more reliably biased than human judges. For many people, a key practical consideration is whether an algorithm has a disparate impact on identifiable groups. Exactly how to test for disparate impact and how to decide what constitutes discrimination, bias, or fairness for an algorithm are surprisingly complex topics, well beyond the scope of this book. The fact that this question can be raised at all, however, is a distinct advantage of algorithms over human judgments. For starters, we recommend careful assessment of algorithms to ensure that they do not consider inadmissible inputs and to test whether they discriminate in an objectionable way. It is much harder to subject individual human beings, whose judgments are often opaque, to the same kind of scrutiny. People sometimes discriminate unconsciously and in ways that outside observers, including the legal system, cannot easily see. So, in some ways, an algorithm can be more transparent than human beings are. Undoubtedly, we need to draw attention to the costs of noiseless but biased algorithms, just as we need to consider the costs of noiseless but biased rules. The key question is whether we can design algorithms that do better than real-world human judges on a combination of criteria that matter: accuracy and noise reduction, and non-discrimination and fairness. A great deal of evidence suggests that algorithms can outperform human beings on whatever combination of criteria we select. Note that we said can and not will. For instance, as described in Chapter 10, an algorithm can be more accurate than human judges with respect to bail decisions, while producing less racial discrimination than human beings do. Similarly, a resume selection algorithm can select a better and more diverse pool of talent than human resume screeners do. These examples and many others lead to an inescapable conclusion. Although a predictive algorithm in an uncertain world is unlikely to be perfect, it can be far less imperfect than noisy and often biased human judgment. This superiority holds in terms of both validity — good algorithms almost always predict better — and discrimination — good algorithms can be less biased than human judges. If algorithms make fewer mistakes than human experts do, and yet we have an intuitive preference for people, then our intuitive preferences should be carefully examined. Our broader conclusions are simple and extend well beyond the topic of algorithms. It is true that noise reduction strategies can be costly, but much of the time their costs are merely an excuse and not a sufficient reason to tolerate the unfairness and costs of noise. Of course, efforts to reduce noise might produce errors of their own, perhaps in the form of bias. In that case, we have a serious problem, but the solution is not to abandon noise reduction efforts. It is to come up with better ones. Speaking of the costs of noise reduction, if we tried to eliminate noise in education, we would have to spend a lot of money. When they grade students, teachers are noisy. We can't have five teachers grading the same paper. If, instead of relying on human judgment, a social network decides that no one may use certain words, whatever the context, it will eliminate noise but also create a lot of errors. The cure might be worse than the disease. True, there are rules and algorithms that are biased, but people have biases too. What we should ask is, can we design algorithms that are both noise-free and less biased? It might be costly to remove noise, but the cost is often worth incurring. Noise can be horribly unfair, and if one effort to reduce noise is too crude, if we end up with guidelines or rules that are unacceptably rigid or that inadvertently produce bias, we shouldn't just give up. We have to try again. Chapter 27. Dignity. Suppose you have been denied a mortgage, not because any person has studied your situation, but because a bank has a firm rule that people with your credit rating simply cannot get a mortgage. Or suppose you have terrific qualifications, and an interviewer at a firm was greatly impressed with you, but your application for employment is rejected because you were convicted of a drug offense 15 years ago, and the firm has a flat prohibition on hiring anyone who has been convicted of a crime. Or maybe you are accused of a crime and denied bail, not after an individualized hearing before an actual human being, but because an algorithm has decided that people with your characteristics have a flight risk that exceeds the threshold that would allow for bail. In such cases, many people would object. They want to be treated as individuals. They want a real human being to look at their particular circumstances. They may or may not be aware that individualized treatment would produce noise, but if that is the price of such treatment, they insist that it is a price worth paying. They might complain whenever people are treated, in the Supreme Court's words, not as uniquely individual human beings, but as members of a faceless, undifferentiated mass to be subjected to the blind infliction of some penalty. See Chapter 26. Many people insist on an individualized hearing, free from what they see as the tyranny of rules, to give people a sense that they are being treated as individuals and hence with a kind of respect. The idea of due process, taken as part of ordinary life, might seem to require an opportunity for a face-to-face interaction in which a human being, authorized to exercise discretion, considers a wide range of factors. In many cultures, this argument for case-by-case judgment has deep moral foundations. It can be found in politics, law, theology, and even literature. Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice is easily read as an objection to noise-free rules and a plea for a role of mercy in law and in human judgment generally. Hence Portia's closing argument. The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. It is enthroned in the hearts of kings. It is an attribute to God himself, and earthly power doth then show likest God's when mercy seasons justice. Because it is not bound by rules, mercy is noisy. Nonetheless, Portia's plea can be made in many situations, and in countless organizations. It often resonates. An employee might be seeking a promotion, a would-be homeowner might be applying for a loan, a student might be applying to university. Those who are making decisions about such cases might reject some noise reduction strategies above all firm rules. If they do not, it might be because they think, with Portia, that the quality of mercy is not strained. They might know that their own approach is noisy, but if it ensures that people feel that they have been treated with respect and that someone has listened to them, they might embrace it anyway. Some noise reduction strategies do not run into this objection. If three people rather than merely one are making a decision, people are still given an individualized hearing. Guidelines may leave decision makers with significant discretion. But some efforts to reduce noise, including rigid rules, do eliminate that discretion and might lead people to object that the resulting process offends their sense of dignity. Are they right? Certainly, people often care about whether they receive an individualized hearing. There is an unquestionable human value in the opportunity to be heard. But if individualized hearings produce more deaths, more unfairness, and much higher costs, they should not be celebrated. We have emphasized that in situations like hiring, admissions, and medicine, some noise reduction strategies might turn out to be crude. They might forbid forms of individualized treatment that, while noisy,